an advantage, I think. I don't have too many things to correct this. Now, I think while I'm up here, it'd be great if you'd have Joe and Roy up here, don't you think? Up here, standing right on each side of me, holding this map up, don't you? Would you like to do that?
Yeah.
You guys get on each side there.
I know you should pick Navy guys. Sorry about that, Jeff. When you want the job done right, you get the Navy.
There you go.
I think you're upside down.
That's for the Army.
I was going to see if Jim would notice that.
That's the way the Navy works it?
Hold up higher in my head till you get tired, okay?
Well, the disciples are supposed to turn the world upside down.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Joe, that everybody in Colorado Springs appreciates the Navy the way you do. That I think he was talking about Colorado Springs. I heard about the Navy man that was asked where he's going to retire. He said he was going to put an anchor over his shoulder and head inland. And the first town he got to where somebody said, "What is that?" he was going to drop it.
You ready?
Well, you notice that, not quite.
Oh.
When Ingrid asked me for a title, I said, "Why Pearl Harbor?" Because Pearl Harbor doesn't make sense except in the context of history. So at first, I want to trace a little bit about the Japanese buildup. 2,500 years ago, the Japanese worshipped a sun goddess by the name of Amaterasu. And her title was Sun Goddess. And she was the only real deity in their worship. And in her teachings, at least the folklore, the fables that came up around, she said there would be a day in which her descendants would rule the world, and there would be a peaceful world under the one true God. So this had been in the back of Japanese minds for 2,500 years. Now, how many Japanese believe that, I don't know, but it made a good propaganda angle when they got some politicians and military people ambitious to rule the world. So now you can hold it up. When you get tired, why, you can rest for a minute, you guys. Yeah, just push against the ceiling real hard and push up there. It won't be quite such a strain. Right, I checked back there, and you can't see the pins. In 1894-95, China was attacked by Japan. And in the peace terms, can you find Formosa? Up here, Taiwan, up here, she got to keep Taiwan. So that was the beginning of territorial expansion. And also, China had been the primary influence in Korea. And so she was allowed to supplant China in Korea. 10 years later, the Russians were expanding into China. They leased Port Arthur from the Chinese for 25 years. But Japan didn't like the expansion, and so they attacked, made a sneak attack on the Japanese fleet, the Russian fleet in Port Arthur, and defeated the Russians. As a result of that, the peace terms, she took over the Russian influence in Manchuria, and also got the southern half of the island of Sakhalin, which is the northernmost of the Japanese islands. Then in 1910, Japan annexed Korea. In World War I, the Japanese hooked up with the Allies, and as a result, she got the German possessions. There's a huge province of China, Shantung Province. By the way, China used to lease out all kinds of territory, not just Hong Kong. But they had leased Shantung to Germany. And after the Germans were defeated in World War I, Japan took over that lease in Shantung, a province several times as big as Japan itself. It had many more people in it. And then she also got the Caroline Island Group, all the German colonies and colonized islands north of the equator. So you can see the buildup was proceeding. In 1927, the Prime Minister of Japan, a gentleman named Tanaka, signed what is known as the Tanaka Memorial. And it was presented to Emperor Hirohito, who approved it in 1927. This was a 100-year plan for conquering the world. The first phase was to secure Manchuria for the raw materials and manpower they needed. So in 1931, they annexed Manchuria, changed the name, set up their own government in Manchuria. The second phase was to occupy what they call the Southern Resources Area. The three raw materials they needed, which were not available in Manchuria, and they didn't have or couldn't buy, rubber, tin, and oil, were in Malaysia and Indonesia. So their goal in phase two was to secure what they call the Southern Resources Area. Between 1935 and 1938, they captured Peking, Shanghai, Hankow, Canton, and all the major cities in China, so that in 1940, they were able to set up the Wang government, which was a puppet government of the Japanese. So they had all of China. After the Vichy government was set up in France, they negotiated with France to occupy all of northern Vietnam. So, you see, they were doing pretty well on their build-up here. In 1940, they signed a pact, a pact of steel, they called it, with Germany and Japan. And a part of that was that eventually Germany would invade the United States through Canada and Japan through Mexico. That was a long-range plan, but that was in their war plans they had made up. In 1940, Japan resigned from the League of Nations, who were opposing her build-up. In 1941, she occupied the rest, the southern part of Indochina. In 1941, she had continued, Japan had completed training and equipping a 200,000-man army in Taiwan, supported with 800 aircraft and 94 transports, been ready to go. The southern tip of Taiwan is only 200 miles from the northern tip of the Philippines. So the purpose of this army was to invade the Philippines. On July 26, 1941, President Roosevelt had been negotiating with China, had been supplying supplies and military equipment to China, tried everything he could to discourage the Japanese occupation, but since Japan wouldn't listen, he put an embargo on oil and scrap iron sales to Japan. He persuaded the government of Great Britain and of Indonesia to do the same. So here was Japan entirely dependent on foreign oil with only a 15-month supply. So that was a critical date, and their whole war machine, their whole plans would collapse without oil. So that made it very urgent that they secure Indonesia as soon as possible. Indonesia, once they refused selling oil to them, then their war machine ground to a halt without that. Now, that was the crucial day. They knew they had to attack. If you look at the map, you'll see that Japan was well positioned all in this area, but right between Taiwan and Indonesia sits the Philippines, which was an American base. So they could not operate freely with as long as the Philippines was not in their hands. They knew from captured intelligence that our plan for defending the Philippines involves stationing our battleships in certain strategic areas. Now, those ships, if they'd gotten out there, could takes a long time to land 200,000 people. And they would have played havoc with those transports landing. So they came to Pearl Harbor for one main reason, and that was to disable the battleships so they could get on with their invasion of the Philippines. On December 22nd, they landed full-scale landing in the Philippines, almost before the Pearl Harbor attack force got back. Now, of course, they did not want to be attacked by our aircraft, or did not want our aircraft to follow them back to their carriers. So their attack consisted primarily of disabling the battleships and any other part of the fleet they could, so that they could get on with their invasion of the Philippines. Okay, guys, thanks much. Now, the attack on Pearl Harbor was not an isolated attack. The same day, on December 7th, that they attacked Pearl Harbor, they also made attacks on United States possessions, Wake Island, Midway, and Guam, and Hong Kong. And on the 1st of January, they entered Manila. And pretty soon, their buildup was a lot larger than that. Well, back to Pearl Harbor. Now, I'll have to do a little focus on this overhead, I think. Now, this is what... is Pearl Harbor all around. It has a narrow channel coming in. Navy Yard is back in here. This was Battleship Row along here. There are a few ships on this side, but this is looking at it from this side. Excuse me?
Point out where the Navy base was.
Yeah, the... actually, it's scattered all around here. The main Navy Yard is over here. The submarine base is here.
Well,
this was the...
There we go.
Okay.
Two submarine bases.
Main Navy Yard over here. Submarine base here. This is the Naval Air Station on Ford Island. There were destroyers all around here. So on the morning of December 7th, there were 164 ships in port. Now, all these weren't combat ships. That includes the small craft and the Coast Guard, 164. Why were there 164 ships in there that morning? In last-minute negotiations with Japan said, we don't want war. We will, to prove to you that we don't, we will send a special peace ambassador. He was an Admiral Grutze. So on Friday, December 5th, he landed in Pearl Harbor on his seaplane, bringing him from Japan. And President Roosevelt said, now to show him of our peaceful intentions, why, bring the third of the fleet that we ordinarily keep out on patrol into harbor so he can see that we're peaceful. Now, I was a part of that third of that fleet that was on patrol. We came in Friday. The harbor was so jammed and so many people that Marina and I had been married 11th of July. We're living there at Pearl Harbor. And I had to wait 2 hours for a bus to get home because there weren't enough buses. We had to shuttle between Honolulu and Pearl Harbor. That's how jammed up that it was. The security arrangement was that the Navy had responsibility for security 50 miles out to sea. The Army for 50 miles surrounding the islands. And the Marines were responsible for internal security. The
Army ordinarily had patrol planes out. But as a part of the peace gesture, they called off a patrol. So there were no patrol planes out at this time. Actually, the Army had a radar, which was capable of detecting aircraft for a couple hundred miles in every direction, but they only operated it between sunrise and sunset. So at sunrise, it was turned off. Actually, we had the only fleet radar on the battleship I was on, but we weren't on alert, so it wasn't even turned on. Nobody was even looking at it at that time. Well, the harbor you see is jammed. Now, also to keep it in perspective, there were only 14 of the combat ships of those 164 that were damaged or sunk that morning. There were a lot of ships that were undamaged. Well, for example, out in here, you see these destroyer nests. I think about 30 destroyers that weren't touched out in this part. They didn't touch the sub base, they didn't touch the industrial navy yard, or they didn't touch the tank farm over here. And for those of you that saw the film Pearl Harbor and saw the scene at the hospital, they didn't attack the hospital either over there. So they came in with, I haven't got these numbers memorized here. They had 40 torpedo bombers in the first wave of 183. And this is a Japanese plot of the torpedoes. This was my ship right here, the West Virginia outboard, Tennessee inboard. And we took the brunt of the attack. Most of these torpedoes were aimed at and hit the Oklahoma and the West Virginia. They said they got a couple of them landed in the mud over here, and then they shot a few of them on this side. But that's what the 41 torpedo planes did with their torpedoes.
Do you show the Arizona?
Yeah, the Arizona was hit early in the attack, so they didn't have to follow through on it. The Arizona and the Vestal were right here, and the Nevada back here. The Vestal was a repair ship, and just one little story that on that, when the first wave came in, there was a quartermaster on watch, and he saw the first plane. He told the officer of deck, that's a Japanese plane. And the officer of deck asked him, he might have had too much to drink the night before. But he had been in the Asiatic fleet. He knew a Japanese plane when he saw one. He raced down and told the captain, there's a Japanese plane out there. And the captain had served in the Asiatic fleet. So he ordered the ship underway. And they got the ship underway before the Arizona blew up, because they were that alert. The Vestal, however, the nearness of the bombs spread the plates apart, and she had to beach over at Pearl City to keep from sinking. The majority of the planes that came in that morning were horizontal bombers. And after the Arizona caught fire, there was a lot of smoke, and they apparently weren't too accurate anyway. That this is, again, a Japanese plot, and it shows 48 bombs that one group of planes dropped. And they plotted the hits and misses. See these circles here? Not one hit out of the 48 of that particular flight of horizontal bombs. I haven't seen the rest of them. But they all fell short. And you see how many of them here? Six of them right here aimed for the West Virginia. And they all missed. We did take a couple of thousand-pound bombs. Around the rest of the island, they hit all of the air stations. Ford Island, where the battleships were, Marine Corps Station at Ava, Schofield Barracks, Wheeler Field, Pickham Field, Bellows Field, and the Kenai Naval Air Station. So they hit every air station, I believe, count was 119 U.S. aircraft that were destroyed. The Japanese also plotted the damage they thought they did to the West Virginia. And they were about right. And we had one hole that was 140 feet long here. But this is what the torpedoes did. Another came back and knocked the rudder off back here.
Well, weren't there a number of navigators on that West Virginia at the time?
Yeah, we probably had about 90 that were involved in some degree of Bible study. Now, Joe, will you turn this on? I'm not sure we can get in focus. I've got a little clip here. If we can make it work faster than drop the telephone here. That's sound someplace.
Where the source of contamination actually is. John and Kelly, it could be months before it's actually repaired. We're told that it actually could cost as much as $3 to $5 billion.
It's a headline.
All right, let's hope they get that situation cleared up. Thanks, Mike.
Sure.
59 years ago today, the Japanese unprovoked attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. At Memorial Park in Colorado Springs today, many gathered to honor the sailors and airmen that died in that attack. News 13's Joe Cole was at today's ceremony and joins us live from the Veterans Memorial in Memorial Park. Joe?
Kelly, it's known as one of the bloodiest days in American history. December 7th, 1941, or as we call it now, Pearl Harbor Day. The events that transpired that morning left the United States no choice but to enter into World War II.
It was a day that I got caught with my pants down.
And so did most of the Pacific Fleet. With Christmas less than 3 weeks away, most ships had returned to port at Pearl Harbor. And at 7:53 on the morning of December 7th, 1941, in the words of one soldier, all hell broke loose.
Ships and airplanes, even though it's 59 years ago, it's as fresh in my memory as if it were a year ago.
That's Pearl Harbor survivor Jim Downing.
We were 5 miles away. We heard the explosions, and the aircraft shell explode in the backyard to a crater 25 feet wide. So in the next 15 minutes, we were in the midst of it.
The bombing may have been 59 years ago, but don't think for a minute that today's servicemen and women have forgotten.
It's like when you see somebody who lived through Pearl Harbor, you say, well, thank you for being there, because you were there, now I'm here.
To also remember and appreciate the ones who died for our liberties.
And for those that survived, there's even a Pearl Harbor motto.
Remember Pearl Harbor, keep America strong, so that it won't happen again.
In the Pearl Harbor attack, the United States lost about 6 battleships, 200 airplanes, and more importantly, 2,400 lives. Lives that are memorialized here at the Veterans Memorial in Memorial Park. Something, if you get a chance, you might want to check out. Kelly, back to you.
Thanks, Joe.
That picture has been shown many times, that there was a life photographer got up early in the morning about the harbor. And he was looking for something interesting to photograph. So he found it pretty quick. So he had the best quality photographs that you could ever expect to get of that whole event as he sat up there and used up all the film he had filming it. Now I think we'll have time in just a few minutes for some questions maybe if you'd like, but I want to tell you about two incidents that... Here's one. This was my ship right here. Marin and I were married July 11th, and we'd been out to sea, came in on Friday, December 5th, and I mentioned how long it took to get home. Well, I was high enough rating that I was allowed to stay ashore overnight. Married men were. Most of the single men were not allowed to stay ashore. So we were manning the Navigator headquarters in Honolulu. That was Saturday night, had a big meeting Saturday night. Marina made breakfast for about eight guys that are staying with us. And right in the middle of breakfast, while these explosions began to occur, and an anti-aircraft shell landed in the backyard, dug a crater about 25 feet across. One of the fellows had a Bible study on one of the ships. He had his car. He saw what was happening. He came back. We all got in our uniforms as quick as we could and got down. But the fleet landing for the boats was right here. And the boats were all busy picking up men that had been overboard. There was fire coming out in the Arizona about 50 yards there. And so we had to work our way down and catch a ferry boat over to the landing. Well, my most anxious moment, the tanker Neosho is tied up right here. She had 6 million gallons of aviation gasoline. And the captain decided there was too much action on Ford Island. So instead of heading out to sea, he headed into the subbase. And as I was walking right here, I was maybe 25 yards from that and wondered when the Japanese were going to drop a bomb. And no place to go. You know, they cleared everything within a quarter mile if they had. But they never hit her with anything enough to blow her up. But I didn't feel comfortable from that time on. You could dodge the Japanese stuff or think you could, but then there's no way to get away from that tanker. We got over to Ford Island. The ship was already on the bottom. I went across the Tennessee, slid down the gun barrel, and about all I could do was fight fires and take care of the dead and wounded. But after the action settled down a little bit, one of the fellows I knew most of them on the ship because I was a postmaster at the time. And he came up to me and he said, Deacon, he said, you know, when I got blown over the side, I ran out of breath, and I knew that I was going to drown. And I said, now, God, he said, I knew it was those cigarettes. That's the reason I didn't have any breath. And he said, I said, God, if you would just give me enough breath to get ashore, I'll never smoke again. So he looked up at me and gave me this good testimony. I looked down his arm. And here was a lighted cigarette. But the next morning, the dispersing officer was trying to get things under control. And, of course, all of our pay records, everything we had, been destroyed. So he started having us swear out statements to make out a new pay record. Well, I went into his office. Now, this dispersing officer we had on the ship, he was... I did business with him every day, so we had a real friendship going. And when I walked in to sign my statement, he stood up and he came over to me, began to breathe kind of heavy. He ran his hands up down my arms and he said, Deacon, am I ever glad to see you? Well, let me just backtrack a little bit. That his mother... Every time she wrote a letter, she had a verse of scripture at the bottom. And when I go see him every day, he'd show me these verses. So one day, I went to his office, and he said, you know, everybody call me Deacon on the ship. He said, I bet you my mother put a verse on that letter that you don't know. And I said, well, you're probably right. What's the reference? So he kind of stumbled through 2 Chronicles 7:14, and I said, does it go something like this? My people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways. He got up where he was sitting. He took that letter, he slammed it on the desk. He said, I give up. You know every verse of the Bible. And I tried to tell him that that was probably the only verse in the Second Chronicles that I did. But he wouldn't believe it. So that was a relationship we had. So when I walked in his office, he came over, ran his arms up and down my arms, breathing heavy, and said, well, Deacon, am I ever glad to see you? And I said, well, I'm glad to see you too, but we've never had a ceremony like this before. And he said, do you know who walked out that door just before you came in? I said, no. He said, the chaplain. He said, he told me he had just buried you. Well, there was another man on the ship, that same last name as mine, who was killed during the attack. And it was his funeral that he had conducted. When I look back, just to wind up here, over the most people I've talked to, well, what were your emotions? You know, we don't know what you saw, but what did you feel? I said, well, there was anger, probably at the top, that our trusted leadership, political and military, had both failed us. I was angry at that. I was angry that the world leaders let Japan make that buildup you saw and never did anything to stop it. But I belong to a Christian organization that had its roots in the British Navy, and I got the publication all the time. A few months before this, you remember that the British Expeditionary Force had to be evacuated from Dunkirk. Between World War I and II, the French built the Maginot Line between France and Germany, so Germany could never cross. So if Germany didn't play by the rules, they went through Belgium around the end of it. And the British Expeditionary Force was forced to evacuate. So 350,000 of them, they're waiting to be evacuated. So this Christian man wrote in his testimony, he said, I found out that Germans were bombing and strafing them. They said that you couldn't dodge it. You might as well enjoy it. So he organized a soccer game. They played soccer while they were bombing and strafing them. But he said, I had the deepest peace that I've ever experienced in my whole life. I knew that I was going to be in God's presence just in a few seconds. So I just went about that peace. He said, I can't describe it. Well, when I got involved particularly with the Neosho, thought it was going to explode any minute, I had that same peace. And it's never been duplicated. Well, that's been a life-changing discovery. Because the observation I've made, when there's danger, the peace of God floods the heart. If there's no danger, it doesn't. So when I get bent out of shape about something, I say, hey, there's no danger. It's all false alarm. If there was any danger, I would experience that peace. After doing what we're doing there for about a couple hours, the Tennessee battleship next to us was practically untouched. I had a friend there that I gave my wristwatch to keep the fuel oil out of it. And I said, do you know anybody up in the galley? I'm kind of hungry. So he took me up the galley, get a sandwich. I looked at the clock on the wall, and it was 11:45. And if you had asked me how much time had elapsed between about 8:15 and 11:45, I would have said 30 minutes the most. Mm-hmm. The things moved so fast that I couldn't believe that it was 11:45 already. Things were so jam-packed. Well, that's a few thoughts and observations. I might have missed something you're interested in. Anybody have a question, a comment?
Jim, to what extent were your thoughts with Marina during this time?
Well, of course, that was my main thought. The Japanese didn't bomb Honolulu. We didn't know how strong the Japanese were. We thought an invasion might come. When we were separated that morning, we never knew we'd see each other again. And it was pretty hot all the rest of the night around there, everybody that could hold one got a rifle and they shot at everything and moved, so you're about as much danger from our own security forces as you were. But that was my main concern when I left her, and that was, you know, we had only been married 6 months. I hadn't had the opportunity for a honeymoon yet. But you see the ships being in the harbor like the picture is. Honolulu is 5 miles up here, so that's not a very good way to fight a war where your unexploded shells land over the city that you're trying to defend. But a few of them did, so most of the damage that was done in Honolulu was done by our own aircraft shells.
Jim, again, the Kellogg Treaty, that was what, 1927? The Kellogg Treaty that limited the tonnage of the Japanese warships. How did that play into the situation?
The Japanese disobeyed every treaty they ever signed, and including an agreement that none of the signatories of the agreement would attack another nation without a formal declaration of war first. So they violated every agreement they signed. And when the League of Nations began to back down on them, they just resigned from the League of Nations.
Afterwards, memorializing those who have passed away and nurturing those who are wounded, talk about some thoughts about that and, you know, some of the buddies there that were no longer there anymore.
Yes, well, I know that we were didn't have any organized effort going on after word was given to abandon ship. You know, everybody did what he could. But being in the post office, I knew well over 1,500 people. I knew practically every one of them. So when I would see a body, I would make a note. I want to write his parents. You know, I'm the only person that will know. So anybody that I knew, why, that's what I did. Then in the afternoon, when things cooled off a little bit, a lot of my friends had been burned very badly in the oil. So I went over, and most of them were in suspension. So I took a notebook and went around and said, give me your parents' name and address, and a brief note. So I went home that night, or as soon as I could get to it, and typed up the notes. I still got some of them. The guy sent me back later on that. But, you know, if I'm talking to a non-Christian crowd, I'd like to talk about one of the guys I visited over there. His name was, last name was Knuckles, Claude Knuckles. And here he was in suspension, you know, pretty badly burned, and I recognized his face, and I said, what happened? And he said, well, I was down on the main deck, and a bomb went through his battleship California, blew up in the ear. And when he came down, he fell in the same hole that he'd blown up. But he went down one more deck than he thought he was. Well, on the main deck, there are escape doors. And so he headed for a door. At the next deck down, there's solid bulkhead, steel. So he went over, falling at the steel, you know, trying to get out these doors. He knew where he was. Well, if anybody was ever sincere, he was sincere in believing there's a door. But no matter how sincere, if there's no door, you can't make one being sincere. So I tell my non-Christian friends that I hear a lot of times, doesn't make any matter what you believe as long as you're sincere. But it's possible to be sincerely mistaken. And he was sincerely mistaken about where he was, so he got burned while he was trying to get out of the flames and discovered he was one more deck down than he thought he was.
Jim, what was our relationship with the chaplaincy at that time? Were they real supportive?
Well, the Navy was very small back in those days. And I'd been in the Navy when the war came along, 9 years. And I hadn't met in that time two chaplains that preached the Bible. And if I can make a summary of the messages that we heard every Sunday morning It was kind of the same outline all the time. That is, if you will do something nice, see something nice, and say something nice, why, you'll be okay with God and man. So kind of a variation of that theme. And by NATO regulation, the chaplain has to sponsor voluntary Bible studies workshop. So the chaplain is very cooperative. And we had one who, you know, had a good relationship with, and he wanted our approval, you know, so he told me one day, he said, now just tell me, what do you want me to do in order to get your full support and approval? I said, on Sunday morning, when you've got that crowd together, preach the gospel. Make it clear what the gospel is. So the next Sunday, he preached one of the best gospel messages I've ever heard. So we all beamed. Next Sunday, we went up there again, and he preached one of these other do-good sermons. He saw we kind of scowled a little bit, and he said, now, what's the matter now? And I said, we want you to preach the gospel. He said, again?
Jim, back here.
You said you had about 90 navigators on your ship alone. How many others were there spread around? And maybe everybody knows it, but give us the ramifications of what Pearl Harbor did as far as the navigators are concerned.
Yeah, we had a good thing going on all the battleships except two, and most of the carriers and cruisers. People have been trained, the navigators were well positioned throughout the fleet when the attack broke out. And of course, with the guys we had, I think there were about 13 of them, if I remember right, that were killed. But the rest of them spread out. So you see, they infiltrated the fleet. So by the end of World War II, the navigators were communicating with people on 1,000 different military addresses throughout the Army and Navy. So the navigators were well positioned on December 7th.
At what point did the Army get involved with the navigators? Or the other way around?
Well, the navigators early were involved with civilians. A lot of young men went to service or were drafted. So we had guys that we were in touch with, you know, as civilians that went into service. And then once mobilization started, we never had the same proportion in the Army as we did in the Navy, but well represented on most of the major installations. Of those 1,000 military addresses, more were Army than they were Navy by the time the war was over.
Tell them about Fujita.
Yes, I've got a pamphlet here. The Japanese officer who led the raid was Lieutenant Commander Fujita at the time. And he survived the war. He was only a handful of the officers that survived, that is, Pearl Harbor. So after the war, he was writing a book, and the name of his book was to be called No More Pearl Harbor, because he had great remorse over that act. But he didn't know, where are you going to get the power to restrain man's primitive instincts? So John MacArthur called him down to his office one day for consultation, and when he got off the train at the railroad station, American missionary gave a tract, and this tract was the account of the life of Jacob de Chaser. He was one of Doolittle's crew members that was shot down after the raid they made early in 42, and was a prisoner of war with the Japanese. While he was in prison camp, he asked for a Bible, and the Japanese guard gave him the New Testament, and he became a Christian. So when he got back to the States, he went to Bible school, went back to Japan as a missionary. Well, this tract was about him. So when Fujita saw the tract, he said, now what would make this man that was our enemy want to come back as a missionary? So he read in the tract that it was the Bible that changed his life. So Fujita got a Bible. And as a result, he became a Christian. I've got his story in my folder here. Well, he linked up with a retired Chicago police captain in youth ministry, and headquarters were up in Denver.
So he used to come down to Colorado Springs pretty often, stayed at the castle, Glenary, a number of times. And Marina and I had some good conversations with him.